and to have them treat the medically indigent, one way would be to do it through county or hospital or district clinics where the state tort claims limit would apply and ostensibly would apply to the physician there as well. The public body that's providing the service can purchase the malpractice coverage for the volunteer doctors who are there.
Representative Clark, Charlie, help me out. How is the proposal you just made any different from Senate Bill 833, I think it is, that encourages maternity care access clinics, requires the health division to talk about, to create some rules so that we know what these things look like, and then extend state tort claims status to those clinics, which you folks oppose?
If a hospital district that's a public body, if a county that has a county health clinic, they've got the tort claims limits. You don't need to have Senate Bill 833 to extend it to a tort claims limit. It's when you allow every hospital, clinic, doctor, or any other entity in the state to set up a program and say they have the tort claims limits too, that we oppose that, which is what Senate Bill 833 does. So if you've got, I mean, it would seem to me there would be plenty of opportunity in existing county clinics and hospitals for retired physicians to volunteer their services and to have the hospital who will be providing the care and really providing care that they have to provide anyway to bear the what in many cases, I mean, I know with OBGYNs or neurosurgeons, the insurance is relatively high, but you can get tort claims limits insurance for physicians that are doing your routine medical care much, much less expensively. And by having the retired physicians practice in clinics, in hospitals, or with other doctors, you're also helping to ensure that the quality of care that they're receiving is much more adequate than it would otherwise be, where this bill lets them just open up their own house and start practicing out of there with no necessary contact with anyone else and have no liability. And one other point, I think Mr. Cooney jumped right on this, that when you have a retired physician in the chain of care, of service, you have somebody assisting on an operation for free, the person that's getting operated on, again, under the terms of the bill, doesn't necessarily know they've got a retired physician operating on them. But if there's malpractice, you're going to have everybody in the whole chain of care blaming the retired physician, and the retired physician may be saying, hey, yeah, probably was me. So there'd be no liability. And you could have people who had insurance who paid for the whole thing. They just didn't pay that retired physician.
Charlie, what if we did with the outpatient care thing? Meaning you wouldn't have anything but what's generally viewed as minor surgery, which would be done in clinics. You wouldn't have the open heart, you know, that kind of scenario. They did kind of confine it a little bit in that regard. Do you kind of feel that that's a false confinement, or that's not going to happen, or is that not practically true? Are hospitals going to let these folks come in there when they know that they're not going to be able to, without requiring them to have big insurance policies before they're going to let them assist in surgery or operate?
Well, I guess we would be opposed on two or three points, Chair Baum. We'd be opposed as a matter of principle. On the outpatient thing, you know, really people are doing tonsillectomies and eye operations, so quite serious operations on an outpatient basis. I don't think you get too far away from that by limiting it. And if the hospitals want to use these folks, I mean, I agree with Representative Markham, they're getting a very great resource free. And it's a very small, I mean, $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 a year for these routine procedures. The hospital or the clinic could shell that out and have them covered by insurance. And so I don't see what the need is to say, well, we're going to have this doctor here, nobody's going to pay anything for malpractice, and there's not going to be any liability. And it doesn't make sense. We have outlined the to get to Representative Mannix's point on the insurance that's paid by physicians in this state. I think the root of the problems that we're talking about is really in the insurance industry and not the tort system. You can see all the insurance that have been paid in the last 10 years exceeds by about $200 million the amount of claims that have been paid. And it's for this reason insurance premiums have come down very substantially in Oregon. They really were ripping off the public, and they've come down very substantially. I think I've mentioned 30% in the last 4 years. I think they came down in 1 year, 25%. So I believe it is more than 30%, substantially more recently. And if you look at this chart on page 3 of the different premiums, if doctors had paid those premiums for the last 10 years to a state insurance fund, and those had been the same claims paid out, you'd have well over $100 million in a fund right now that could very close to pay all future medical malpractice claims without anybody paying any more premiums. So the state, I mean, I guess what I'm saying, there's lots of different ways to deal with the cost of malpractice coverage. One of them is a state fund, which we proposed in 1989 and 1987, but the OMA gets a big kickback from CNA every year, so they oppose this. There's other states have adopted...
What does that mean?
Well, you'd have to ask OMA how much they get from CNA each year. I understand it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000.
Kickback?
Well, they fund CME
medical malpractice and other and continuing medical education.
Right.
Isn't that part of the process though, of being a good insurance company?
Kickback.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, you know,
that's how they work.
educating their.
Well, I think you'd have to look very carefully.
We
at
do the
figures.
PLF does the same thing for us.
You get one too.
Yeah, you get that.
You
notice.
Get a kickback?
No, I get trained to try to avoid mistakes.
I think that you do see that the PLF does provide Oregon attorneys the very lowest premiums in the country and covers everybody, which you can't get in attorneys in almost every other state in the country cannot get insurance. Certain of them. But here they can and they have to, and it would be a very excellent way to lower premiums and in the long run provide cheaper and better service to the public. In Wisconsin, they flatten the rates. You have psychiatrists paying $2,000 or $3,000 a year or less for their malpractice premiums, and you have OBGYNs paying $29,000 a year. It used to be in Oregon, you had surgical and non-surgical categories, and that was it. And they were relatively close together, and there was no differentiation, and you spread the risk that way. But then with more competition between insurance companies, they started to chip off the low-risk stuff and force the high-risk end up. So now you do have that great disparity, and it is probably poor women and probably poor women in the rural parts of the state that are getting the worst access to medical care in their OBGYN because of that high rate. But if you adopted a flattening of the rates, you'd have everybody paying a basic $5,000 to $8,000 a year and having the same coverage that's available to everybody now.
Charlie, answer a question for me. I got your little chart on the direct premiums earned and direct losses. The ratio in 79 to what we have today is it's gone up 5 times in losses paid over that 10-year period. And the direct premiums have gone up 2.5 times. And in 1987, we had a drop. We had a pretty break-even situation there in 1985 where we had 23 versus 20. And I just, we have kind of a really skewed graph. Is there any projection on your part as to where we're headed? I mean, it looks like some of my fears and the reason why I'm pretty supportive of this kind of thing most of the time is because I see the litigation and losses rising quickly, twice the ratio of premiums paid. You know, more people winning more money in court. While medical technology is supposed to be getting better all the time, we're still, apparently, according to that, we're making more mistakes, or people are suffering more. Maybe attorneys are just getting better at pointing it out, whatever the issue is. But, do we go back in the future to a rate of, does it come back again to a break-even rate like it did in 85? Is it cyclic? I mean, do we have any long-term studies? This confirms my worst fears about where we're headed, because let's say we did clamp down on the insurance, then we aren't going to get ahead because we'll just go up on the losses. And we just keep, and then this hurts the health care in the rural areas, and golly, do we have service or do we cover for the single person that gets hurt? That's kind of the trade-off here. You give us some input over the long term.
Well, I think if you look at the loss ratio, loss paid ratio, I think below 50%, the insurance company is making a very substantial profit. They're doing very well. They've been doing very well over the course of this time. There have been increased losses. I don't know I can do some research on that if you want, Representative Baum. I don't know the reason for that, but I do know that there are not a lot of cases. I mean, you got 6,000 doctors practicing in Oregon. I've gone over and I can do another analysis of the DIF.
Well, it's gone up 400%. You know, statistics. And premiums have gone up 250%. So,
well, you know, inflation has gone up 150% or so since that time too. Yeah, you started at an incredibly low basis, but I would say you've seen premiums come down 30 or 40% in the last 5 years, and that you are likely to see a continuation of that trend. I don't think you're going to see a trend going back up.
When?
But you're not talking. I mean, people talk about runaway court verdicts. We haven't heard of any runaway court verdicts. We haven't heard about any injustices in Oregon courts in medical malpractice cases. There are comparatively very, very few cases. I think in the analysis we did on Representative Clark's Senate Bill 833, an OBGYN has less than a 1 in 3, more than 3,000 chance of being sued for every 3,000-plus babies that are delivered. There's one adverse verdict.
Representative Miller has a question, Charlie.
Mr. Williamson, the runaway case means what?
I would say it's where the I'm not saying that they exist in Oregon, but if there's a runaway verdict, I would say that generally means where a jury is believed to have given more than a plaintiff was entitled to.
So not. I've read one. I think this weekend, $11.1 million for a football injury. That's not a runaway.
I don't believe so. If you would like, I can bring the attorneys down to speak with you on that case and explain that. You have a permanently paralyzed teenager who needs care the rest of his life on that particular case. And Mr. Bocci and Mr. Pippin would be available to talk to you on that if you would like.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Charlie, I don't know how many times this session we've had bills in front of this subcommittee limiting liability or extending state tort claims status to somebody. Trial Lawyer Association has opposed those, and I understand why, and I think you've made a very eloquent argument that we ought not be essentially shifting the costs of these social goals onto injured people. I guess what I want to ask you about, just, we don't need to spend much time on it, is somebody said to me the other day, they said, what's really happening is a piecemeal revisitation of the entire tort liability question that happened in 85 or 87. A, is that true? And B, if it's true, does it need to be done? Does a revisitation of that whole issue need to be done in other than a piecemeal fashion?
I would hope not. I wasn't here in 1987 as a lobbyist for the trial lawyers. I don't really know what went on in the committee hearings. It does seem to me that we are talking about, and I think, Representative Clark, I guess it seems to me that there's a lingering sort of perception that things are now the same as they were then, when you did have a huge public relations campaign. It's continued. I mean, you see advertisements in the in magazines from various insurance companies talking about how the tort system's out of control. I think if you look at some of the examples in those ads, they don't apply in Oregon. But I think there's just this feeling that was commenced back at that time that really you don't get justice in court. It's just that rich people get ripped off by a bunch of poor jurors with a smart lawyer who's representing a plaintiff. And it doesn't it doesn't seem that courts are dispensing justice, so you should try and protect people that have saved up something from the court system. And I don't think that in reality that situation exists, at least today, if it ever did. So we We don't think it needs to be revisited. If you want to revisit it, it certainly would be fairer to treat everybody the same than to take out poor people, which is what seems to be the drift in this session.
Chairman.
Representative Clark, one more question.
Because the only check on the system right now that keeps, I don't care if they're innocent, guilty, rich, poor, the only check on the system right now that keeps someone from being, well, I guess they have to at least have some sort of insurance, because people who don't have any assets typically don't get sued, or they don't get sued very, very far into it. The only check on that entire system right now is yours and yours and mine and Baum's and Mannix's and Edmondson's judgment, and Randy Miller and judgment when we're sitting down with a client about whether we're going to take that case or not, because of the contingent fee system. That's the only check on the system, is my judgment about whether this case is worth my gamble. My client has no gamble, because I put on the TV set, no obligation, right? No legal fee charge unless you recover. So there's no risk to my client. The only check in the entire system is the lawyer's judgment about whether this case is a reasonable gamble for that lawyer. And I wonder if the whole system ought to be based on that single roadblock, that single check.
Well, I think that you have a judge, you have motions that inundate you, the lawyer has to do a tremendous amount of work in any of these difficult cases to get even to see a jury, but you have the judge and you have the jury. And we haven't showed any place where these checks have been they haven't been working. We haven't even seen any examples here of frivolous cases. I'm sure there are some, but we do have the frivolous, the ORCP 17 that was passed back in 1987 says if you bring a frivolous case, the attorney has to look at the possibility of paying those attorney fees. And the costs.
Well, it's not the frivolous cases the truly frivolous cases that are driving the system. It's the borderline cases that are driving the system, it seems to me. I appreciate you entering into the dialogue with me. It's a good faith dialogue I'm trying to enter into with you. I don't have an agenda with it.
Mr. Smith would like to respond if he could.
Representative Clark,
identify yourself there, Greg.
Sure. I'm Greg Smith. I'm an attorney licensed in the state. I'm also a registered nurse. Licensed in the state. Before going to law school, I practiced nursing in three different states in critical care units. I want to really address the issue that you just brought up because I think that's crucial. Lawyers who represent injured patients are representing people who don't have hardly any economic locomotion. They don't have money available, say, from a doctor who's retired from a successful practice, or an insurance company that's been able to build up resources over decades. And so that lawyer, when he's talking to injured people sitting in his office trying to exercise his judgment, will I take this case? He has to look not only at this particular client, but how long it's going to take him to get through the process, what the probabilities are that the client is going to be successful. We already know that across the board in America, 80% of medical malpractice cases tried to a jury verdict wind up with a defense verdict. So that's a probability that contingent fee lawyer has to look at. His counterpart, who's the defense lawyer, gets paid an hourly wage from the insurance company. He has no risk taking any case. The contingency fee lawyer knows that because he's dealing with an injured client who can't afford to usually front costs, that those costs are going to have to be fronted by his own firm and by his past successes. And he knows that he has to front those over a period of probably several years. And even if he's successful, then he has to gamble that the courts of appeals are going to uphold him on that. So first he has to beat an 80% probability that he'll lose, and then we have to take a look at the type of case we're talking about. The case that we're talking about here, medical malpractice litigation, some of the most expensive type of litigation you can possibly get involved in. I do this type of litigation. I have not seen one medical malpractice case that you could front for less than $10,000 to $15,000 in costs and have any chance of being successful. So what you're looking at isn't just a judgment, a flip of the coin, well, do I feel like going after a doctor today? You're looking at a lawyer who has the expertise and the past experience and success to even be able to consider it, putting his money where his mouth is, looking at a potential client of his that he's willing to go the long, hard road on because the facts are clear enough to back up that kind of a gamble.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson has a comment, then Representative Clark.
I just want to question that the $15,000 you said that a case takes to the minimum amount it would take for an attorney to front a medical malpractice case, that is the cost of going all the way through trial?
What that basically gets down to is, unless you have something that is just so open and shut and didn't involve hardly any medical records, you usually have one or two or sometimes three and four different specialties and subspecialties involved. Each one of those needs to have a determination made by an expert hired by the plaintiff to deal with issues of liability, which include negligence, causation, and damages. Each one of those experts will charge a range between $100 and $300 an hour to review medical records. And the defense lawyers pay the same kind of money, the insurance companies do. Once the review of those experts has occurred and the opinion has been received, the lawyer then goes ahead, files his claim, etc., takes it down the pike. Then you have the normal costs. You have your deposition costs. You have your trial fees. But then you also have to bring these experts in. They miss a day, sometimes two or three, of their own practice. You pay for that.
I appreciate some of the testimony here, because very often when Charlie talks to us, he only talks to us about why we need to protect the poor people. But I hear you telling us why we need to protect the poor lawyers, and I appreciate that, because it's been a deficit. I've teased him about that before. But I know you aren't trying to make any of us feel sorry for the lawyers, because that's not going to work. But what you're trying to tell us is that there is a check on the system, and the check is that it costs a lawyer $15,000 to process one of these cases. Is that what you're trying to get to?
The check on the system is that people who represent poor people have to do it on a contingency fee basis because they can't afford to pay an hourly rate. To do that, they have to be very selective about the cases they take, or they won't be in business and they won't be able to represent other injured people. So the check on the system is a judgment check. It's an economics check, and it's a strength of the facts check on the validity and the merits of a case. And if that lawyer makes a wrong judgment, the least that's going to happen will be that his client will lose, he will lose, and if he really makes a bad judgment, then this frivolous lawsuit factor comes into play.
But you aren't trying to suggest that the overall system is ineffective to produce an adequate crop of lawyers willing to take these cases at this point?
No. And the issue here isn't lawyers. It's not lawyers. It's the ability of injured people to get representation and to get some justice in here. And I want to address some of the standard of care issues relating to the medical practice as well.
Before we get into that, why don't we let, that's another subject, why don't we let Representative Clark ask?
Just to wrap it up, I appreciate that response, and that was the question I asked. Is there any check on the system other than the lawyer's judgment who's got to take the case? Because it is an economics decision. Remember, my firm does medical malpractice cases.
Right.
My partners are plaintiff's lawyers for medical malpractice cases, and I understand the process that he goes through when he decides whether or not he's going to take that case. And I guess the only question I'm asking is, his judgment, what he's willing to gamble, his time and the firm's time and his money for fees, is that the only check on the system? And you and I both know that one of the first questions we want to find out is, what's the insurance situation? And if there's no insurance, then the economic decision is, this isn't worth it for me, I can't take this case. And it just seems to me that the poor get it both ways.
I just make one more point on the check or two. I mean, I thought it might be interesting for you to know, Larry Wobrock, who handles these cases as well, indicates to me he only takes between one and two cases for every 50 people that come to him with a case. I haven't done a medical malpractice case in 12 or 13 years, but it's the folks that bring these cases are very, very selective about them, because they have to put an enormous amount of their own time and resources into them. I went to a CLE back in the 70s, and Chuck Paulson said, he gave us a test. He said, the test that you want to do for whether or not you'll take a malpractice case is the Oh My God test. When you explain to a layperson what happened to your client, they should look at you and say, Oh My God, they didn't do that. And if they don't say that, don't take the case. And I think it's very close to that. Juries are so prone to siding with the doctor, that you really need something outrageous or horrifying to warrant a verdict.
Mr. Chair, thank you for letting me deal with that for a while. Appreciate that.
Representative Mannix has a question. Is that right?
Well, when you're talking about the cost of taking a case to trial, 98% of these cases don't go to trial, do they?
I don't think that's an accurate statement.
I'm throwing out a figure. 90%, 95%?
I haven't got the exact figure, but I know it's much, much lower than your car accident type cases that actually settle, and that's because, first off, you have a lot more complexity. It's a lot easier to confuse a juror, and also most of the policies require that the insured give permission to settle, and you're dealing with
what is your percentage for the number of cases filed involving medical malpractice where you actually file a complaint and actually get to trial?
I'd say probably about 10% or more.
So, all right, so when I said 90% don't get to trial, you're saying 10% don't get to trial or 10% do get to trial?
10% or more get to trial.
Okay. 90% then don't get to trial. Costs about $100 to file a complaint.
No, that's where the misconception comes in with medical negligence, what was just talked about as far as the number of cases that are screened. I look at 30 cases for every one that I file. By the time I file a case, I've already had experts review it, get back to me, tell me that either the case doesn't have merit and you eat the cost, or it does, and you've already spent thousands of dollars before you spend that additional $100 for the complaint.
And the cases you don't take, they go down the street and look for somebody else.
The cases that I don't take, I give them the medical literature and the reports of the experts who say that there wasn't a departure in standards or that you can't prove it. I give them that, and I tell them why I'm not going to represent them and that I don't think it's in their best interest to go forward. It's my experience that of all of the people that I've talked to, only two people have gone out and sought additional opinions, and I'm not sure that either one of those have gone forward.
When we talk to physicians, and they talk to us about the number of cases that they see against them, as opposed to the few that ever get to trial, what we routinely hear is the nuisance value settlement, the I don't want to take it to trial because I don't want my reputation sullied, even though I may win with a jury verdict. What we hear is that there's a tremendous value to just the threat of a lawsuit. Secondly, there's a tremendous value to having the lawsuit and the threat of a trial, and that those values are paid out of the fear of the litigation process.
May I respond, Representative Mannix? I would like to read to you, if I could, I'll make you a copy of this chart. And this is just OBGYN cases, but they are the most serious. In 1990, these are all cases reported to the DIF by insurers, filed or unfiled. There were 34 claims closed in 1990, 11 of which were paid. 35 claims closed in 1989, 13 of which were paid. 15, there's about a half to a third, less than a half of the claims. Overall, from 1984 through 1990, there were 241 claims closed and 91 claims paid. So you're not looking at, this is on OBGYN, but you're not looking at an outrageous amount. On average, it's 34 claims closed a year by insurers on OBGYN claims, of which they paid 13 claims. You're not looking at a lot of, whether they're filed or not, you're not looking at a lot of cases going to trial or settling before trial.
Well, the reason why I asked to chime in at this point, I was actually asked to chime in several minutes ago. You said, in effect, that poor people are going to have to give up their legal rights in order to get medical services. There seems to be a misunderstanding of the whole policy choice here. The choice seems to be between getting some physicians to volunteer their services for free or not having their services at all. And the question is, how much do we give up? What are we giving up in this process in order to convince them to give us something? And we have to make a choice as to what is the social policy, what is the benefit that society gains. If we encourage 100 physicians to put in 100 hours each of free legal services as retired physicians that otherwise would not be provided, is the cost to society so great that we ought not to do it? That's the kind of balancing act that we have to go through here. You might keep that in mind, but I don't agree with the concept that, well, we're forcing poor people to give up their legal rights in order to get medical services. Actually, they're not going to get the medical services, so the legal rights won't mean a darn thing to them. And we're trying to say, is it worth giving them some medical services with reduced legal rights as opposed to no medical services with no legal rights because there's nothing to sue on because you didn't get any services? You see what I'm getting at?
Well, I understand where you're coming from. And if we were living in Bangladesh or Kurdistan and we actually were up against the wall in our society, we just absolutely couldn't provide anything to anybody without having them give up their legal rights, maybe our answer would be different. But we're, at least according to the Business Journal, providing the 26th highest social services of any state in the country. We're not like we're providing some silver platter to our population here. I don't think you're at that point, Representative Mannix, where you need to decide that. It would be very simple for hospitals and clinics to pay for volunteer doctors' insurance and cover them to provide the services. And you're not at a lesser of two evils situation.
All right, thank you.
It's Representative Bell, then Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, as I start, I assume that in the presentation of the bill, you talked about the need for the bill, right? Was that discussed pretty?
Excuse me?
Was the need for the bill discussed pretty heavily during the presentation of the bill?
Yeah, the proponents
okay,
are up here.
So I won't get into that. Mr. Williamson, I just want to let you know that this is a bill that was real exciting to me because I think that malpractice insurance has scared the seed of human kindness right out of our medical people. And I believe that in a lot of cases, they would be out on our streets, in our little neighborhood homes, pitching in